Hey, today's episode is brought to you by SunsetLakeCBD.com. SunsetLakeCBD.com is not only got a great CBD products, they are a great movement sponsor for this show. They want to remind you that those nurses at St. Vincent's in Worcester are still on strike. 700 out of the 800 are on strike. Tenet, the healthcare, the Dallas-based hospital conglomerate, has now started to supposedly hire scab replacements. These nurses have been on strike now. It's almost their 13th week that they have been out. They need your support. Sunset Lake CBD donated $2,500, and they want to remind you, you can go and help them out, show some solidarity. You can go to we'll put the link in our podcast and YouTube description, but if you look for bit.ly/stvincentnurses, you can go and donate. But sunsetlakecbd.com, they are a great company. They are mostly employee owned. $15 minimum wage. They working outside of Burlington, Vermont. And here's the thing that I just sort of found out recently that I didn't realize. We've all been CBD skeptics in the past. And I was told by, I don't know, just someone I was talking to about the stuff, that a lot of times you can't really trust what's in the CBD products that you get. Sunset Lake CBD. And now I understand. When they would send products, I would get this like booklet almost of third party independent analysis of their products. And you can find that stuff on their website. They work with the University of Vermont to practice regenerative farming practices, 100% organic and no pesticides. So, And the CBD is legit. It is what you see is what you get. And for me, the tincture has been a great sleep aid for me. Occasionally recreational, I'll have one of the pre-rolls and the fudge. And the weekend brew for me is their coffee infused with CBD. Matt's a big fan of their smalls. He grinds it up with his other smokable products, as it were, now legal in New York.
Yep, the lifter smalls lately, folks.
They have dog biscuits, which Emma loves to remind me. I tasted, and they're actually not for humans, but
they're
not
for
bad.
That human, yeah,
not bad. They have gummies.
Those are my favorite.
They really fantastic products. You will and the salve, which I use, and they now have a lotion that is has CBD.
I have it. I haven't used it yet.
But I'm not a big lotion guy, but the salve is as much as I will get in terms of putting anything on my body.
Sam
but
wants dry skin for years and years and years.
It's true.
Yeah,
it's actually true. But my
dry
sister loves
Sam.
It. She's been using it. So check it out. SunsetLakeCBD.com. If you use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, they picked it out. LEFTISBEST. One word, you get 20% off. Check it out, sunsetlakecbd.com. Now on with this show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, June 2nd, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Charles Howard Candler, professor of African American Studies at Emory University, author of the second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. Professor Carol Anderson will be here with us today. Also on the program today, a 25-point Democratic win in New Mexico special election pokes a big hole in the anti-carceral reform argument. Joe Biden hands voting protections portfolio to Vice President Harris. Meanwhile, Shelley Moore Capito to visit the White House today as pressure grows on her colleague from West Virginia, Joe Manchin. The largest global meat producer in the world shut down by a cyber attack. Meanwhile, Joe Biden suspends oil and gas leases in Anwar, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Speaking of suspending Trump-era policies, Biden officially ends the Remain in Mexico asylum policy. And speaking of Donald Trump, Governor Abbott in Texas yanks the licenses of child care facilities housing immigrants there as a way of creating a crisis of for the Biden administration, presumably. New data shows the myth of wealth fleeing high-tax blue states because of taxes. And a new study shows that the lifetime earnings of median male workers from 1967 to 1983 dropped by 10%. One can only imagine what those numbers look like today. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Glad you could make it today, making it today as well, as she does virtually every other day. Emma
pretty
Vigeland.
Much. Pretty much.
Pretty much.
Yeah. How are you doing?
Health permitting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't you're going to bring it up a second day.
Yeah. I don't know why I'm doing that, but I just, I'm just getting used to the fact that it's only Wednesday.
I know.
Or that it's already Wednesday.
And we didn't even tell the audience, we used to have a plastic barrier between us. Sam and I now no longer have that barrier. And it is odd. You are clear in
I'm
front
too,
of me.
That's
and
right.
I'm wearing my glasses. It's
that's
like,
right. Yeah.
It's like the kind of, you know, when you take the 3D glasses off and you put them on in the movie, see the difference. I feel like I got my 3D glasses on.
It's really raising the intensity of our exchanges, without a doubt. The fact that we don't have the plastic wall here, and we are anticipating over the next couple of weeks the entire crew to come back into studio.
Whoa.
And so big changes afoot here, ladies and gentlemen. With that said, we got a lot to talk about today, so let's get to it. There is several moving pieces that are happening right now in Washington, D.C. that ultimately will decide, I think, the fate of the Biden administration's legislative agenda over the next 60 to 70 days. This week, supposedly, is marks the deadline for Republicans' involvement in an infrastructure deal. I got to tell you, I don't think a deal with Republicans is going to look very good. And so I'm going to cop to wanting that not to happen. However, there's a significant kabuki theater that needs to take place where Joe Biden needs to show Joe Manchin that he has done everything to try to do this. This is...
He needs to lay the golden gifts at the throne of King Manchin, right?
Indeed.
And go, pull out all the stops. So Joe Manchin will be happy.
And what's interesting, though, is today Capito is coming for a meeting. Joe Biden is presumably will do his sort of Joe Biden move where he tells the staff, get out. It's just going to be me and Shelley, and that's it. However, simultaneously, yesterday or Monday, I guess it was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he was marking for the first time as a president of the United States has recognized the Tulsa massacre that took place 100 years ago, really yesterday and the day before. He didn't say them by name, but it's the first time that we've heard Joe Biden get out there and start to put some pressure, really, since Kamala Harris was sent to West Virginia and Arizona early in the Biden administration to give a radio interviews about the infrastructure bill. Listen to what Biden said. This came as a little surprise to people.
But today, as for the act of voting itself, I urge voting rights groups in this country to begin to redouble their efforts now to register and educate voters. And June should be a month of action on Capitol Hill. I hear all the folks on TV saying, why doesn't Biden get this done? Well, because Biden only has a majority of effectively 4 votes in the House and a tie in the Senate with 2 members of the Senate who vote more with my Republican friends. But we're not giving up. Earlier this year, the House of Representatives passed For the People Act to protect our democracy. The Senate will take it up later this month, and I'm going to fight like heck with every tool at my disposal for its passage.
Every tool.
Well, I mean, first off, let me just say this. I don't actually think it's the case that Sinema and Manchin vote for the Republicans more than they do the Democrats. I actually just as a matter of fact.
But it's an important rhetorical tool to use in order to get what you want.
It is. I mean, he is singling them out. Everybody knows who he's talking about. They certainly know who he's talking about. And it is. And I wonder. And again, you know, it's very difficult to tell on the outside what they're thinking. Like I said, Kamala Harris was dispatched to do those radio interviews in those 2 states in the run up to the infrastructure bill. She's just been handed this portfolio of...
You mean the stimulus package?
The stimulus bill. Yes, yeah, sorry. And she's been handed this portfolio of voting rights. I don't know what there is beyond marshaling these bills through the Senate and the House on a federal level, what you can do from the vice president's office.
Well, people were joking that you give the VP the impossible tasks, like Biden was tasked with cancer when he was vice president. And it, without the filibuster, my point is just like he says, I will use every tool at my disposal. Dude, you've got to publicly call to do filibuster reform. That's the number one tool you need.
That's what I think he just did, to be honest with you. I mean,
really?
Well, didn't it? I mean, because he knows that you need 10. And so he's talking to and he may be saying, look, I know you don't actually vote with them, but you're enabling them. All we know is that there's a little bit of stick there. He's got the carrot with Shelley Moore Capito showing that I'm willing to reach out. Now, I don't know. This is all speculation on my part.
He's talking about the infrastructure package. There are apparently 10 Democrats who don't want to do filibuster reform behind the scenes is what these people are telling The Washington Post. So, like, this is narrowly, I think, a stick for the infrastructure deal.
Well, it could very well be reconciliation, but he says it in the context of voting rights. I mean, we don't know. We don't know, but it is definitely a slight change. It may be just a reflection of his frustration. However, I hate to be the guy, the pedantic guy sitting around with Joe Biden, although I'm not sitting around with Joe Biden. I seem to remember him saying specifically, give him 6 months. You'll see these Republicans will come around and they will come help us. And I've got some very bad news for Joe Biden. We are 4 days away from 6 months from when his election was finally certified.
From when his bipartisan potion is supposed to kick in, you know, right?
It could be. I mean, maybe it's 18 days. Maybe it's on his inauguration.
Yeah. It's like the vaccine, right? You don't know when full immunity is going to hit. You don't know when the bipartisan antibodies are going to spread in the Republicans' veins.
That's right. My guess is going to be never. But Joe Biden said 6 months. So we're about at 6 months and we will see. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Carol Anderson, who has written a corrective of the history of the Second Amendment entitled The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. We'll be right back in just a moment. Folks, happy to do this business. I mean, I have used this business for one of our key hires here. Did you know that recent data shows that out of all of the female-owned businesses, it's estimated that 1 in 3 is owned by a mom?
No.
That's going to be difficult. Have you ever wondered how these moms and dads, like myself...
Father's
find time to hire for their businesses while juggling with their families. How do I hire people? Got to go home. Got to cook dinner. Yesterday, I had to pick Saul up at skateboarding class.
Yeah, you got baseball.
I got baseball. We'll see if it does the whole rain sold out. Well, it's ZipRecruiter makes it possible. Right now, you can try it for free only at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. CEO and founder Talia Goldstein is one such mompreneur, as I call them. Besides being a mother of two, her personalized matchmaking company, 3-Day Rule, is constantly growing, and she needs to hire several matchmakers a month. Where do you find matchmakers? Well, apparently you find them on ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's powerful technology helps her find people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply. That's how we got Brendan here. Brendan was just out there floating around. ZipRecruiter sucked him up, pumped him through their system, helped me organize who I was going to interview. He showed up. Boom. Bango. Bingo. I don't know. That's,
it's interesting how you view him as some sort of object to be sucked into a system and then spat out to serve your interests. But
yeah, well, that's it. Talia is not the only employer who loves ZipRecruiter. I do too.
Yeah.
4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this specific web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Special offer, only good at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. ZipRecruiter. It is the smartest way to hire. Folks, I never thought I would be someone who thought that socks were important. That, like, you could actually, like, socks made a difference. That was until... well, I started getting the hint again with Brendan. I mentioned, have you ever heard of Features? And he's like, yes, they're awesome. I wear them for running all the time. And I'm like, I've never even heard anybody say that about their socks.
That they're awesome.
Never.
Right.
And I got to tell you, they're awesome. Features engineers their socks based on the different levels of support and performance that your feet need for different activities. So you take in a casual stroll, you take it with their comfortable everyday crew, like I do. Basically, most of the socks I have. Occasionally, I'll get one of their high-performance support with the Elite, like Golf Max or other ones used for running to pretend like I'm actually doing a high-intensity action with my feet when, in fact, I'm just walking.
Right.
But Features has your feet covered. Features is obsessed with making better-performing socks for everything from your daily wear to active wear. You get targeted compression where your feet need it most for better comfort and support. Plus, you prevent your socks from bunching. That doesn't happen to me anymore. They don't slip. They don't slide down into your shoe, regardless of activity. And here's the amazing thing. They are anatomically designed to fit your left and right feet. And they also have like a little L&R on them so you don't get lost. That was for me. I was like, how are you going to... Oh, there you go. That makes sense. Premium materials. Every step you take is cool, dry, and comfortable. If you're unsatisfied at any point, they'll even give you a replacement pair. No questions asked. For me, honestly, like it was a revelation. These socks are fantastic. They feel good as soon as you put them on in the morning. Like I don't know how to really express the idea that your feet wake up, but that's what it feels like when you put these socks on. Brendan, chime in.
They're great. I actually wore them this morning, the mid-calf running sock, compression sock, when I ran this morning before the show.
Brendan gives you an endorsement for anything. You know it's real. I mean, he's super uptight about his like workout stuff.
Right.
He's always talking about sneakers. Every product that I get that I like, he is giving me a recommendation on it. Overall details, custom-like fit, durability, peace of mind, knowing they won't slip or bunch. Folks, check them out. Features is so confident that you'll love their socks. They're also offering $10 off your first pair of Features when you go to features.com/majority. If these are not the best socks you have ever worn, on or off the golf course, as you're walking, they will take them back. That's Features, F-E-E-T-U-R-E-S. .com/majority for $10 off your first pair of Features. feet as in feet. And lastly, if you've always said you want to read more, the Summers is yours for the taking. You could empower your inner reader with Literati book clubs, where you can read alongside the world's most inspiring authors and leaders. I've had great experience with Literati for a book club for Saul. And now they have one for adults. You can join Malala. You can join Stephen Curry, Richard Branson, and more on their next reading adventure. What happens is you're basically in a book club with these people. Authors, leaders, and activists spark lively conversations in 12 different unique book clubs, and Literati delivers their monthly book picks straight to your door. So that means you could talk about Stephen Curry's favorite books with him for reals. You find exclusive interviews with the authors themselves. You won't find any other book club like this. You'd like that, right?
Yeah.
You can follow along with Stephen Curry, and find out what he's reading and what he thinks about the books that you guys are reading together. I mean, you're not reading them together, but you're reading them simultaneously. Well, not
you don't know that we're not reading them together.
All right. Well, okay. All book club members can shop the entire Literati library at discounts with books over 50% off. You can move freely between the clubs, too, if you want, or you use the standard membership to access everything. Choose the books you want delivered. You can reimagine what a book club can be. Redeem your free trial at Literati.com/majority report. Head to Literati.com/majority report to learn more and read more with Literati. Literati.com/majority report. All right. Want to welcome to the program again, or welcome back to the program, I should say, the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University, author of the second, or I should say her most recent, the second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. Professor Carol Anderson, welcome back to the show. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think I told you this when we spoke about your most, I guess your last book, One Vote, excuse me, No Vote, One Person, No Vote, that white rage really for me, help me understand the concept of history, particularly in the context of race. But to see the way that race has, I think prior to that, I perceived some of this has returned, but this dynamic has never gone away. This is linear and it continues throughout. And I learned from reading that book, I think it just hit me that history is really more about I'm just going back and reading chapter one and now I'm on chapter 15 or wherever it is. And this is all part of the same book, as it were. You've done that again, I think, here with the second. Give me a sense of what I don't know if it's a myth, but the understanding that we generally have of the Second Amendment in this country.
Our general notion of the Second Amendment is that it was put in place as a way to protect, create a militia that would defend against domestic tyranny, as well as to prevent the invasion from foreign armies, that it was this bulwark to protect American democracy. That's the myth that we have that is really swaddled in the flag and in the founding fathers. And it has this amber waves of grain just coursing through it. That's the notion that we have. That's what makes it this kind of hallowed ground, so that when anybody starts talking about guns, we hit this hallowed ground of the Second Amendment.
And you outline, where's the first moment where you can see in the formation of this country that at least, a significant, I guess, impetus for the Second Amendment was really about making sure that there was no slave uprisings, essentially.
Right. And where that became just, and this is part of why I'm documenting the role of the slave revolts and the statutes that are coming in the wake of those revolts. And those revolts are leading to statutes saying they cannot have arms. So the enslaved cannot have weapons. Also saying that free Blacks cannot have access to weapons. And so you're getting this sense of Black as threat to Americans, to white Americans. And where I saw it just stunningly was in the Virginia ratification debates, where Patrick Henry and George Mason are just going toe-to-toe with James Madison, because Madison had put federal control of the militia in the Constitution. And what the Virginians saw, and Madison was also a Virginian, but what these anti-federalists saw was that that was going to leave them defenseless against a slave revolt, that they could not trust the federal government to bring in the militia if there was a slave uprising, because that federal government had folks from Pennsylvania and had folks from Massachusetts. And as Patrick Henry says, the North detests slavery. And so that lack of trust said the only way we're going to really sign on to this thing and not push for a new constitutional convention is if we have our rights protected, our rights to control Black people protected.
So what are the, I mean, so walk us through the sort of the machinations in terms of the development of the actual Second Amendment from that moment. I mean, so they're mistrustful of the federal government coming in and providing them, you know, resources and military, I guess, to fight a slave uprising. How do they then negotiate that into, how does it develop from there? In terms of mechanics.
And so the mechanics are, is that there had already been a history of the South playing hardball with the Constitution, playing hardball with the founding of the United States of America. And so this is how we get the 3/5 clause. This is how we get the 20-year extension of the Atlantic slave trade. This is how we get the fugitive slave clause in the Constitution. And the ratification of the Constitution was no easy walk. And there had been this massive push to add a Bill of Rights to it, to curtail the power of the federal government. And there had also been a push to have a new constitutional convention. And what Madison was absolutely afraid of was that this new constitutional convention would grab hold, and that would lead to going back to a kind of Articles of Confederation that had a weak federal government. And he wanted to maintain a strong federal government because the Articles of Confederation were not working. And so it was that threat that was dangled in front of Madison that led Madison to be like a man obsessed. So in that first Congress, he is drafting the Bill of Rights, and he is doing all kinds of Robert's Rules of Order to maneuver this Bill of Rights through Congress so that he can get it passed, so that he can short circuit that quest, that drive to overturn the U.S. Constitution. And part of that was the Second Amendment. And so when you look at our Bill of Rights, we get the right not to have an established state religion, the right to freedom of the press, the right to assembly, the right not to be illegally searched and seized, the right against cruel and unusual punishment. And so you get these incredible rights. And then you think about this outlier, this one about the right to a well-regulated militia necessary for the security of the state, given the right to bear arms. It's like, her. That is the basically the payoff to the Southern anti-federalist, that you can control your militia. That means that you can put down a slave revolt. So sitting in this Bill of Rights, what we have is a right to control Black people.
I guess, give me a sense of like how you would, if the idea was that we want to avoid the tyranny of of like, I mean, the, you know, because I feel like, you know, the part of the story that we're told is like, you know, if the king, if somehow there's a king that develops, we want the ability so that that person doesn't have the monopoly of force. But you're giving it to the state, right? Like, you could have that problem within the context of the state. If we were going to write such a thing, we wouldn't have had well-regulated militia, would we have had?
No. And so that language of militia is really key there. Because what we saw with the militia, again, you know, we talked initially about the story that we hear. And so that story during the War of Independence, how the militia took on the king's forces. But the militia's actions were really spotty. They weren't reliable as a force. They could not withstand a professional army. Drove George Washington crazy. He was just apoplectic about it. We also have, right before the Constitutional Convention, Shays' Rebellion. And Shays' Rebellion are when you have white men attacking the government over taxation and the seizure of property for non-payment of taxes. And they are headed toward the Springfield Armory. When it's hard to pull together a militia, they couldn't pull together a militia to take down Shays' Rebellion. And so Boston merchants had to basically finance a mercenary army to quell the uprising of these white men who did not want to pay taxes. And so our narratives about the tyranny of government and our narratives about fending off a king or a foreign army, a foreign invasion, just don't hold water with the historical reality of what was going on at the time. What the militia was good at was putting down slave revolts.
I just want to be clear on that. So the idea is that if you are a contemporary at that time, and you are trying to see potential dangers, it would be hard to sort of imagine that you need to provide, when as using Shays' Rebellion as the example, that you need to provide for a some type of bulwark against a federal army or some type of like monopoly of force, because that didn't really exist at that time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so there was also this fear of a standing army, because that was seen as a force of tyranny. And so what this militia really was about was putting down slave revolts. That's where they had been consistently effective. They weren't consistent in terms of protecting government. They weren't consistent in terms of fending off a foreign invasion. What they could do was put down a slave revolt.
Sorry, but yeah, I just am curious, too, about how that played into the whole, you know, there were only a few thousand black soldiers in the Revolutionary War, right? There must have been just this intense anxiety about, or maybe I have the numbers wrong, they seem to vary, about arming slaves or black people. I know a few states, I think, offered freedom if slaves were to enlist, kind of giving them the tools to potentially revolt, teaching black people how to use weaponry. That seems to be central to some of the anxiety here.
Yes. And so during this War of Independence, by 1775, you had a ban on having black people in the Continental Army, a 13 colony ban on having black people in the Continental Army. But the British are kicking some USDA grade A prime beef butt. And the reality is that the militia cannot withstand it. The reality is that they're not getting enough white men to enlist in the army. And so it gets to the point where they're like, if we're going to win this thing, we are going to have to arm black people. That's the only way we're going to be able to win this war. And so you see these states Pennsylvania saying, you will get your freedom if you enlist in the army. So providing manumission for black men who fight for the patriots. When the war is headed south, when the British are like, we're getting ready to hit the soft underbelly of the revolt. And so you get the request from Washington, from John Lawrence, who was a son of South Carolina, and Washington's emissary, saying, the British are coming. The British are really coming. And we don't have enough white men to fend off an 8,000 force that is coming to just destroy us. You must arm the enslaved. We don't have enough white men. The power is in the vast number of enslaved black men that you have. And South Carolina flat out refuses, basically saying we are willing to take our chances with the king rather than arm those whom we have enslaved.
How much did South Carolina, were they willing to arm even free blacks? Or was there even a significant number at that point that it would have made that much of a difference? I mean, they seem to be, and as you go on and you recount the sort of set of statues that sort of begin to proliferate at that time, the idea of arming even free black men is prohibited.
Yeah, it is absolutely it's terrifying. And that's one of the through lines that I want to just make clear in this book, is that the fear of black people, the fear of blackness, the fear of black people, seeing them as a threat, as a danger, as something to which you have to always keep your guard up and maintain your safety. That was so part and parcel of the decision-making that went into the arming of black people. So that even when they are armed, it's with the proviso that it is at the behest of and under the control of whites. That becomes the, okay, we can give them weapons, but we control how we give them weapons and we control what they do with those weapons. So the fear of black people is central to the Second Amendment and is central to this story.
So let's move forward in history and track some of that. Let's go forward to when we saw the reluctant, I guess, arming of free black men in terms of our conflicts. We saw it in 1812, and then we see it again in the Civil War. But again, it's pretty reluctant.
Oh, absolutely reluctant. And again, here you have with the War of 1812, a war with the British again. And so much of that dynamic was the same dynamic that we saw in the War of Independence, where the British were offering the enslaved freedom for taking up arms against the Americans, so you have a race war inside the war, where you have the reluctance of the Americans to arm African Americans. And we see this particularly in New Orleans, where there is a black militia that is really effective, but that black militia has been denied access to arms. It has had its leadership removed, and there's been massive pressure from whites to disband this black militia. But Andrew Jackson comes down and he sees that basically that British Armada coming. And he's like, okay, we need not only that black militia, but I need a couple of more basically squadrons of black folks who can fight. That's what I need in order to take on the British. But after the Battle of New Orleans, that they win, that the British lose, you don't see this kind of embrace of black contributions to American democracy, black contributions to fighting for this democracy. Instead, what you see is the kind of disarmament and the erasure of African Americans from that war. The same with the Civil War. With the Civil War, initially there was a ban in the Union Army of recruiting, enlisting black people to fight in this war. It was only a couple of years after the war began, with massive pressure from Frederick Douglass and massive pressures from the war, where you see the enlistments beginning to open up and you get a segregated army fighting in the Civil War. And again, after that war, the push for disarmament of black folks was intense, because again, the fear of Black people and the fear of the weapons that they would bring became paramount.
By the time we get into the early 1900s, has the concept of the Second Amendment evolved at all? Because we have in this period, you know, there are a couple of accusations of Black soldiers essentially committing atrocities or firing on white citizenry. Has the Second Amendment evolved in the understanding of it? I mean, how does the myth of the Second Amendment, if it does, change during that era?
The Second Amendment didn't have the kind of primacy then that it has now. So the Second Amendment was really understood as the right to a well-regulated militia, and there had been some discussion about the right to self-defense, but it didn't have that individual right to bear arms component to it. And so we end up in the mid-1930s with a Gun Control Act dealing with submachine guns with the gangsters. And the courts ruled that those kinds of guns and sawed-off shotguns were not part of a well-regulated militia under the Second Amendment. And so civilians did not have the right to those kinds of weapons.
Can you talk about the just deluge of harassment and violence directed towards Black troops specifically? I mean, in 1906, this Brownsville incident in which Roosevelt essentially dishonorably discharged all of these soldiers who were a part of this battalion. Can you talk about that incident? Because I think that's key.
Yes. So in Brownsville, Texas, Black troops were coming in to replace white troops. And the town was outraged, just outraged, having these Black soldiers in their town. And so the harassment was clear. Just the harassment, I don't even know how else to put it, of these Black soldiers. And the barrage of get them out of here. We're going to get rid of them. We're going to get rid of them. And so a white woman yelled rape and said there was somebody in khaki pants. And so that had to be a Black soldier wearing khaki pants. And so then I'm trying to make sure I'm not confusing this with the Houston incident. But in Brownsville, they were consigned to the camp that they couldn't leave. And what happened was that there was a shooting that night, that somebody had gone into Brownsville shooting up the town, and that a police officer was killed, a horse was killed, and a white man was wounded. And the mayor basically told Teddy Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, the Black soldiers did this. Get rid of them or the mob will. And so the soldiers, when the shooting was going on, the captain, the officer, called roll call, and all of his men were there while the shooting was going on. And they can't be in two places at the same time, but that didn't matter. The what mattered was that whites had accused them of shooting up the town and killing a white man and injuring another white man. And that was all Teddy Roosevelt needed to hear. And so when they interviewed the soldiers were like, we don't know who did it. We don't know who did it. Well, that narrative became that they were being, yet you had this kind of conspiracy of silence among these Black soldiers, and that they refused to honor the military code and creed. And so therefore all of them, all 167, would be dishonorably discharged. Now, getting a dishonorable discharge really is like it's like the scarlet letter. It so precludes the opportunities that you have in life. And there was no courts martial. They were just discharged. That sent the signal about how these soldiers were not U.S. soldiers. They were just, as they kept being called, the N-word. That's what they were.
Where were we in terms of the black codes at this time? These were laws that were essentially passed, pre-Civil War to govern essentially, the movement, the lives of free black people as well as slaves. But where does that evolve at that? By the time we get into the early 20th century, where are we with those?
And so the black codes that came really after the Civil War, those are gone. But now we're in the era of Jim Crow. And so we see the rise of Jim Crow in the 1890s as you start seeing the violence really raining down on the black community to put them back in their place, to make sure that they understand that they are not citizens. And you see the laws really coming up, the massive disfranchisement of black voters happening at this time. The laws that are providing for separate and frankly unequal facilities in public accommodations, in schools, in virtually in cemeteries, in the Bibles that you swear on for church, in Coca-Cola machines. So this is the rise of Jim Crow and the kind of virulence of anti-blackness in this moment.
Was there any attempt by black people to develop their own militias? I mean, as we have this wave of massacres, and really only in the past, it feels like the past 10, 15 years, are we even, recognizing those? The Tulsa massacre was obviously just recognized really the first time by a president anyways, 100 years later. But we had a series of those through Reconstruction. Was there ever an attempt of black people to organize some type of militia to defend communities like or something?
African Americans had guns. As much as the disarmament was happening, they kept their guns as much as they could because they realized it was the means to self-defense. But what happened with that self-defense is that they could never have enough guns to mount the response that would come in from the state. And so when I talk about Elaine, Arkansas, for instance, so Elaine, Arkansas in 1919, where you have black sharecroppers who are having their wages stolen from them. Imagine working all year, and at the end of the year, you don't get paid. That kind of massive wage theft. And so they begin to organize for a labor union. Well, when wealthy whites get wind of this, that, black people have the audacity to believe they ought to be paid for their labor, that they send a scouting team to hunt down, to surveil the meeting at Hoopspur Church, where the black people are meeting to organize for this union. And there's a group of sentries out on the porch because they got a whiff that whites were going to be angry if they knew what black folks were doing. When the scouting car is there, there is gunfire that is exchanged. And from that, a white man is killed and another white man is injured. The mob violence that rained down on black folks in Elaine, Arkansas, was only matched by then the governor being able to call in the US Army that brought in machine guns to just mow down. It's like up to 800 black people killed. So the weapons that black people had for self-defense were no match against the depth of the violence that the state could bring in retaliation for black self-defense.
Let's move forward in time because the Black Panthers, essentially, was there any major sort of like, this seems to be the first the most prominent, I guess, aggressive move by black people to assert the Second Amendment right, for protection, basically through the World War I and World War II era. and maybe into the post-war. And then, of course, they're met with Ronald Reagan. But before you address that response and the Mulford Act, was there anything sort of analogous during that period of 40 years in between their attempt in Arkansas and in California in the 60s?
Yes, we had Columbia, Tennessee. So in Columbia, Tennessee, there had been an altercation between a black veteran who was trying to protect his mother from a beating and a white store owner. The veteran, they fell through a plate glass window as the black veteran is beating on this man. And whites were just stunned. So this is after World War II. This is 1946. And whites were just stunned that this black man had the temerity, the audacity to put his hands on a white man. And so whites began organizing and mobilizing to basically do to Columbia, Tennessee, what had happened to Tulsa, to basically a massive pogrom to just eliminate black folk out of Columbia, Tennessee. Well, these are black veterans. And so they had their weapons, they knew their military positions, and they took them and they started defending their community from this planned massacre. The response from the state was to go in with the National Guard and round up these folks who were protecting their community from a mass lynching, and to then charge those black folks with murder. Thurgood Marshall from the NAACP comes down to defend the folks at Columbia, Tennessee. He is almost lynched in the process of trying to defend black men who were defending their community from a mass lynching. So we have these instances of black folks defending themselves, and the response from the state is, this is a right you do not have.
And then that becomes, as we move forward, that becomes codified at one point in California. Let's talk about that. And then it becomes operational, I guess, in the era that, you know, in the past 20 some odd years, we have seen that, despite the fact the loosening of gun laws. But talk about California.
So in California, what you had was massive police violence raining down on the black community. In Oakland and in L.A., just raining down on the black community, and the police being non-responsive to addressing that violence. And so the Black Panthers for Self-Defense, co-founded by Huey Newton and Bobby Seals, decided that the way to deal with this was to police the police. They knew what the gun laws were in California, and they knew the language of the Second Amendment. And so they carried their weapons openly and kept the legal distance from the police as the police are arresting and interrogating folks in the black community. Well, the police did not like this. And they went to Don Mulford, an assemblyman out of California, and said, "You got to help us." And the response, with the help of the NRA, was to craft the Mulford Act that banned the open carrying of weapons. But it was the open carrying that was the Black Panthers' legal means to police the police. But here you have the sense of, no, we've got to have some real gun control here. We've got to have some real safety here. We can't have these black folks openly carrying weapons like this.
And then we move and those laws were fairly durable until the Supreme Court decided talk a little bit about how the Second Amendment then evolves over the course of those 30 years, I guess, into, you know, what would have empowered the Black Panthers at that time. Right.
So what we saw happening, we had the Gun Control Act of 1968 that was really a ban on the Saturday night specials, these cheap weapons that flooded into the black community. And then you had the Heller decision The Heller decision was 2008 in Washington, D.C., where the court ruled that the Second Amendment was actually a right to self-defense, that that was a central component of the Second Amendment, and that these gun control laws, in fact, violated the Second Amendment. But D.C. is a federal bastion. And so the next case was the McDonald case in 2010 that then made it about state laws. And there they went after the laws in Chicago about gun control and said that violates the right to self-defense. And so with that, it made gun control laws legally very difficult. Another component in this was the push that we had from the NRA to mount these stand your ground laws that said we already had the Castle Doctrine. That's an old, hundreds years old doctrine that if you're in your home and somebody comes into your home that's not supposed to be there, you have the right to defend yourself and to ward off that intruder. What Stand Your Ground does is that it says anywhere that you have a right to be, you have the right to defend yourself. And so it makes the domain a lot larger. And it says, if you perceive a threat, then you have the right to use lethal force. Well, when Black is the default threat in American society, that perception of threat basically puts crosshairs on Black people. And we see that in the way that the law has been operationalized so that whites are 10 times more likely to be ruled a justifiable homicide when they kill somebody Black than when somebody Black using Stand Your Ground kills somebody white.
And this ends up being also the same principle operates for police officers in this regard, right? I mean, I have a Black suspect or even just a Black person who has not necessarily been named as a suspect. The approach is there is more of an existing threat just generically speaking, just in the moment that I roll up. I don't need to see anything. I don't need any other context. This is, you know, I don't know. If I roll up on a white person, threat level is one. If I roll up on a Black person, threat level is seven or something like that. And that, you know, that's their perception. And that goes a long way to justifying their actions, at least with respect to our laws.
Exactly. I mean, so you think about the case of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy playing in a park pavilion by himself with a toy gun. And granted, it didn't have the orange cap on it to say this is a toy gun, but Ohio is an open carry state. And the law says as long as you're not pointing that weapon at someone, you're not a threat. But the police rolled up and within 2 seconds, they shot him. They shot him within 2 seconds. And what they said was, he was a threat. We felt threatened. But you didn't see that same threat level with Kyle Rittenhouse, who was the white teenager who illegally obtained a gun, carried it across state lines, and went to Kenosha, where there was a protest against a Black man being shot in the back by police. And he is welcomed by the police. They were like, we really appreciate that you're here. Want some water? And after Kyle Rittenhouse shoots down 3 men, killing 2 and wounding a third, he walks to police with his hands up as if to surrender, and they ignore him. They didn't see a threat with this white child carrying this rifle. That's the difference.
The none of these laws, when we talk about open carry or whatnot, and we could also Philando Castile. I mean, I imagine people remember that instance, but it's hard to come up with a scenario where if you're in a state where, you know, you're allowed to carry a gun, how you would have approached being stopped by the police any differently in that context.
Right. I mean, he followed NRA guidelines. That say when you are pulled over by the police and you have a licensed weapon, alert the police that you have a licensed weapon which is what he did when he was asked to show his ID, because he didn't want the cop jumping to see this gun in the glove compartment. And instead, the response from the police officer was to shoot Philando Castile dead.
All right, let's. So where do we go from here? I mean, with a different interpretation and understanding of the Second Amendment, at least, what do people do with that in the context of a Supreme Court that has decided, no, now is the time that we're going to find an individual right to carry. We are probably, you know, I don't know, months away, weeks away, years away, not many, before it becomes even more explicit with this Supreme Court. What do we do with that information?
And I think part of what we must do is to remove the kind of hallowed ground on which the Second Amendment stands, that kind of veneration that it has. You know, you see these billboards, this is Second Amendment country. Well, what that means is that this is a country that is using the weapons and the law as a means to control Black people's rights. And so we need to understand that the Second Amendment needs to be treated the way we treat the Three-Fifths Clause, that being in the Constitution did not make it venerable. What it was a bribe to the South in order to help form the United States of America. By systematically denying the rights of human beings to their basic rights. When we understand it that way, we're having a very different conversation about gun laws in this nation.
Carol Anderson, the book is The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. We will put a link to that in our podcast description, our YouTube description. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful. Thank you, Emma, as well.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment. Folks, before we go, you know, we talked at the beginning of the show. Do we have that Pete Buttigieg clip? I don't know if we have time for it. But let's play this clip, because this, I think, shows more of the administration sort of like willy-nilly a little bit. Carrot and stick. Carrot and stick. Here on the day that Shelley Moore Capito is showing up at the White House 2 days earlier, the Transportation Secretary, Pete Buttigieg, comes out and says, clock's ticking.
So some Democratic lawmakers who, and I'm not just talking about the Bernie Sanders types who are very skeptical of Republicans to begin with, even though Sanders does have a record of bipartisan work, but some people who make a tradition of it, who normally cut deals, they say, you know what, Buttigieg, you've negotiated it enough. The Republican counterproposal isn't much more than the U.S. would have spent anyway. You're wasting your time. Take a listen.
It's an old expression, fish or cut bait. I think we're getting to that moment.
We hope to move forward with Republicans, but we're not going to let them saying no stand in our way.
But at some point, we have to move forward.
Casey, Schumer, Durbin, these are people who generally would be in favor of negotiating. Are you basically saying that in the next week, if there isn't an agreement, Democrats are going to go it alone?
I think we are getting pretty close to a Fisher cut bait moment, but I'll tell you that on the fishing side of things, the negotiations have been healthy. There's a lot of conversations going on among members of Congress who have come forward with a lot of different ideas, in addition to the discussions that we've had with the group led by Senator Capito. So we believe in this process, but also very much agree that this can't go on forever. The American people want results. We are 13th place in infrastructure as a country now, and probably headed the wrong direction. We are seeing losses to this day, not just things you count up in industry group reports of the millions that are lost when we have port backups, but just individual families paying hundreds of bucks a year in the so-called pothole tax, the invisible cost of wear and tear in our vehicles when roads aren't in good shape. This can't go on in terms of the condition of our infrastructure. Therefore, the negotiations can't go on forever either.
All right, there. So there you have it, and so, they're putting it out there. This, you know, this is one of those things where I'll tell you how this worked out in a couple of months. It was either just a complete folly or it was well played.
Well, we pray that it was well played.
Of course, when I guess we'll have a better sense of this in the next week or two when this deadline wraps up. And speaking of deadline, if you're watching us on Peacock, we will see you tomorrow. And if you are not watching us on Peacock, we'll see you
right now.
Today.
Hello.
There you go.
We got a doozy of a Tucker Carlson clip.
Is there? We got some Tucker stuff. I mean, is there a comprehensive list or book of the various massacres that took place from essentially, you know, I guess starting in 1870 to 40 years ago?
I mean, there should be, but you know, even in reading about the Tulsa Massacre, Black Wall Street, as it was colloquially referred to, they tried to, after it was all over, erase newspapers from the archives and literally cut out articles about what happened. And so a lot of the information is incredibly difficult to obtain because literally the government down there was trying to make sure that the archives did not accurately depict what happened.
Yeah, I'm convinced this entire conversation we're having about wokeness is a result of communications technology allowing access to history like this in a way that has never been before. Like, even to hear people from Tulsa talk about, yeah, we never really talked about this even. Like, and now, like, you can't really avoid the history now.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. It's crazy when you look back on the newspapers from that time. It's not crazy, but it's another stark reminder. A lot of the headlines before it became unavoidable were two white deaths and race riot in Tulsa. And then they just would completely discount the 300 plus Black yeah. people who were burned alive, who were murdered in that specific massacre. And there were many, many more on smaller scales that we'll never fully understand the scope of.
Yeah, I'll just say I'm going back and reading the Bismarck Tribune from the first edition in 1873 when it was a weekly. And old newspapers, not very progressive on race, to name other issues.
Is that right?
It's pretty insane.
I'm surprised about that. I would have thought that those papers would have been very, very progressive on race.
Newspapers, the liberal media.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
What's up, Brandon?
Brandon Sutton is here, ladies and gentlemen, to join us in the fun half.
I love summer colors, right? We got to start dressing brightly. Brandon, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Are you referring to my shirt as a summer color?
Pops.
Oh, thank you. You know, I like to, you know, be a center of attention. I like to stand out sometimes.
You like to peacock?
You know, is that ad or a reference to the pickup artist community?
Just like corporate synergy.
Oh, okay. You know, not really. I find that like the pickup artist community looks a little bit too much like close magicians, like close-up magicians. And I went through my magician phase when I was a kid. And so, you know, I've grown up out of it.
I mean, we could bring pickup artistry to Peacock.
Well, wait a second. Wait, I want to hear more about the magician face because I went through that too.
I mean, I think a lot of people go through a magician phase when, you know, you're around that age of like 11 and 10, you know, the idea of magic really took hold. When I was a kid, I feel like magic was coming back, like actual like illusions, not like the, you know, David Blaine, I'm going to encase myself in ice. And so I took like magic classes. I don't know if you can really call them magic classes, but, you know, I took classes in how to be a magician when I was like 10.
I took those classes when I was a little younger actually was doing birthday parties for young kids.
Oh, well, I never monetized it, Sam. I was not as industrious as you. I just kind of, you know.
Entrepreneur, yes.
Was that kind of just a way to put a little sparkle on your comedy?
Well, I was seven. My comedy was, was still, I was seven and 10 and 11. I wasn't, my comedy
was your anti-humor there by age seven?
Yeah, a little bit. I was deconstructing the stuff. That's where Penn and Teller got their idea.
I think that all comedians have a magician phase. They all go through a magician phase, but they just don't succeed. And that's what makes them comedians.
I think that's probably correct. I think that's probably correct. And then after you're not successful as a comedian, you just go into, doing politics on YouTube. Folks, speaking of which, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, we magically deliver you a show every single day. Like magic.
It is.
Except, of course, Monday, last Monday. But you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. It's your support that makes this show possible. You keep this show chugging along. You allow us to say no to advertisers. You allow us to say no to a lot of different things, actually, and yes to you. So, I don't know. I was trying to make that come home, but it didn't work. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. AM Quickie, you get 7 minutes of headline news every morning. It's there when you wake up. AMQuickie.com, totally free, totally free. You know, one of the things that apparently is driving vaccine hesitancy is that people think they're ultimately going to get billed for it, according to the New York Times. God bless you.
Kaiser Foundation. I don't have any tissues here.
I bring that up as a reminder. The AM Quickie, totally free. Totally free, the AM Quickie. Also, the Discord, majoritydiscord.com. Check it out. And the app, for that matter. You can get so many free stuff. Majorityapp.com, and we never sell your information. We never do any of that stuff. Brandon, what's going on with the discourse?
Well, you know, we're back to our bi-yearly recording schedule, so we should be picking up and recording. Actually, we have our researcher pouring through pages and pages of Fauci notes right now and pulling out all of the good stuff. So ideally, by the time we record again, we're going to have a lot of, I hate to say revelations, but, you know, revelations about the past year of COVID and COVID-related news that we've been talking about, as well as just a general news update.
All right, there you go. And Matt, what's happening on the
left-wing?
Well, I was going to say generally the Matt Leckian universe.
Specifically Left Reckoning tomorrow night. Kurt Hackbarth of Jacobin talking about AMLO in Mexico. That's our guest tomorrow night, 8:00 Eastern. Left Reckoning. Go subscribe to the YouTube page, folks, which is just zooming past 10,000 subscribers. That's way in the rear view now. So thanks to everybody.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half.
You are in for it. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back. Back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck 'em! Fuck 'em!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! Come on! Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
I am a total
pussy.